Case number 13-5353, Aaron DeBacco et al. Appellant versus United States Army et al. Mr. Lazar for the appellants, Mr. Haynes for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. James H. Lazar, representing Aaron DeBacco and Barbara Webster, the substituted plaintiffs for Carl Oglesby, who is deceased. This case involves a Freedom of Information Act case that involves Mr. Oglesby's request for records related to General Reinhard Gehlen, the Gehlen organization, records of meetings at Fort Hunt, records on post-World War II Nazi organizations. In previous trips to this court, Mr. Oglesby won some significant victories, including a fee waiver for records at issue. Pursuant to the 1996 remand of this court, the Department of Army was under an obligation to provide Mr. Oglesby with free copies of records determined to be responsive to the request.
Can I just ask a question? At that point, had the court ordered production of any documents?
Yes. The court had ordered. By that time, there had been probably in excess of 10,000 pages of records provided, including 9,000 pages by the Department of the Army.
And were those provided?
Pardon?
And were those provided?
And those were provided in highly redacted form.
And were they provided with the fee waiver?
They were provided with the fee waiver.
So were at that point, it's just a fact question. I don't have an agenda here. I'm just trying to figure out. At that point, was there an outstanding order to produce further records yet? Or were you litigating whether further records had to be produced?
The situation is that in 1997, the agencies, the government agencies, moved for summary judgment once again. And
so just to catch the narrow question, at the time at which you had a fee waiver,
yes,
and before the government the Army transferred the documents to the archives, was there an order to produce specific documents to you that had not been yet been fulfilled, or was the matter still being litigated?
It was understood, it was represented in court that the Army was going to produce records. They were going to process them. In the fall of 2000 and at a hearing held in January 2001, followed up by a February 5, 2001 status report, the government represented that it would be reviewing records that had become subject to the request as a result of the CIA's concession in September 2000, that it could no longer deny the existence of a relationship between the CIA and General Reinhard Gehlen. And as a consequence of that, the agencies were to begin reviewing and reprocessing what they at that time estimated as to be somewhere between 250,000 and 750,000 responsive records. So, yes, they were under an obligation to produce records. As to the question of transfer, there is some doubt that is, in effect, a disputed issue of material fact, because it is unclear from the record when the records were transferred to NARA. And, in fact, I was informed this week by counsel for defendants that he had learned that the Army maintains a copy of the 9,000 pages transferred to NARA by INSCOM.
That was going to be my next question. Yeah. I guess we have an answer now.
Yes.
Well, in that same conversation, I guess I'll ask the...
It's not a complete answer yet.
Well, I take it the government is not taking the position that it doesn't have to produce documents that it has copies of to you. You don't know the answer.
The position it is now taking is it's evolved over the past week. I had immediately, when I was advised of this, asked that that the government advise the court of this and advise me as to whether or not they conceded that a remand was necessary in light of this. Late yesterday, I was advised that they had decided not to inform the court yet. They were still checking to determine whether or not a clean copy of the records existed at INSCOM, or whether it was a redacted copy, or the extent to which it is a redacted copy.
All right, we'll find that out in a minute.
So okay. That's for them to deal with too. From my point of view, it's not all. It's relevant certainly to the extent that there's a blatant contradiction now between the current representation that they have, INSCOM has files, and the declaration of Bradley Dorris, which was filed in this case in 2012. And if you turn to page 702 of the appendix, paragraph 5.
Can I hold on one second?
Yes.
Do that?
Yeah. Sure.
Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. What paragraph?
So, paragraph 5, you will find there a statement that INSCOM had conducted an exhaustive search and that there were no records relating to the request. That is contradicted by, in contradiction to the current information. Whether or not they were redacted or not, they had something, and it still existed despite the representation that there was nothing more that was not at NARA.
Okay.
The From our perspective, the issue of whether or not they retained the copies is subordinate to the question of whether or not they violated the law in transferring records to NARA in the first place.
Well, if they have copies of everything they transferred, what would the violation be?
Well, first of all, the copies would have to be clean copies, and we don't know that at this point whether they are. The violation would be in the sense that they have delayed for a period of decades the turning over of these records to my clients.
But it wouldn't be because of the transfer. It would be because of the misrepresentation about the fact that they actually retained them, right?
Yes, that's correct. Okay.
Can I ask one more question? Do you, on the Exemption 3 issue?
Yes.
I know there's a question about CIA invoking the National Security Act. Do you challenge the CIA's authority to invoke the CIA Act as an Exemption 3 statute?
It's not that we challenge their authority to invoke it if they have been delegated that power by the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence.
Under the CIA, they can't do anything under the CIA Act without a delegation?
There has to be a delegation of authority according to the statute. The statute is quite clear on its terms.
Which statute? Are you talking about the CIA Act or the NSA Act?
The NSA Act.
Right. I'm saying that if they had just invoked the CIA Act as the basis for disclosure, so they never mentioned the NSA Act.
They do not say that they are acting under the authority of the... There's nothing that says that they were given the authority by the DNI to protect intelligence sources and methods that they are seeking to protect. And that seems to be a clear violation of the law. And if you need to get into legislative history, the legislative history, I think, on it, which is cited in my brief, is quite clear that the purpose for that provision in the Act was to limit the number of officials.
Your brief is a little obscure on the question of whether you mean that the DNI must himself decide every case.
No, I think the briefs are
well, you say they don't, but he doesn't. So therefore, where is the line?
The principal deputy director has the power.
So does the principal deputy director have to decide everything?
He has to authorize it. Now, how he does that
he can authorize it to the director of the CIA?
Yes. And the case law indicates...
Well, if that's the case, why aren't both Intelligence Community Directive 700 and Executive Order 12333 sufficient for that purpose?
Well, I don't find anything in either one that is specific enough convoke that power. I don't think either one of them mentions the specific statutory provision.
So let me just take you through these. You tell me why they're not good enough. Okay. So first we have Intelligence Community Directive 700, and we have I think it's E2. This is a directive from the DNI. Heads of the IC elements, which would include, of course, the DCI, shall protect national intelligence and intelligence sources, methods, and activities from unauthorized disclosure. And then the President's own executive order on the subject, which is 12333, at 1.6 says, at 1.6D says, heads of the elements of the intelligence community shall protect intelligence and intelligence sources, methods, and activities from unauthorized disclosure. So if you agree, this is what I was unclear about, but if you agree that either the DNI or the deputy can delegate, why isn't this a sufficient delegation?
Well, there's no indication that it was delegated in this particular case.
Well, why does it have to be in this? This is a general delegation to protect sources and methods. Are you saying that?
Yeah.
So then I'm back pushing you back on the same question. Yeah. Are you saying that the DNI or the deputy have to, in every individual case, do a separate delegation?
I think it has to indicate that it is relinquishing to the CIA the power to make that determination in the particular case. Yes.
So there has to be a reference to that particular statute?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes.
And what about the provision of the CIA Act, which says, which is 3507, which says, in order to further implement Section 3024I of this title, that the DNI shall be responsible for protecting intelligence sources and methods, which is the section you're relying on, the agency shall be exempted, the agency being the CIA, shall be exempted from provisions of any other law which require the publication or disclosure of the organization, function, names, official salaries, or numbers of personnel employed by the agency. But I is about sources and methods. So isn't that a delegation within the statute itself? or you don't think so?
A bit taken aback by that. That is in the statute itself.
Well, now I'm just reading from the CIA Act.
Are you reading from the CIA Act, not a regulation?
Yes. Section 463507 says, in order further to implement Section 3024I, which is the NSA Act section about... I believe it's the section that authorizes the
DNI
to protect sources and methods. Yes, protection of intelligence sources and methods. It says, the agency, which is the CIA in this case, shall be exempted from provisions of any other law which require the publication or disclosure of the organization, functions, names, official titles, salaries, or numbers of personnel. So do you think that only relates to actual CIA employees?
That actually is an Exemption 3 statute that we did not contest in this case. The one that we're contesting in this case is the one that refers to intelligence sources and methods.
So then what we're down to is the question of, you agree that delegation is possible, and the question is whether it has to be referenced to a specific case.
Yes. Fair? Right. I think that's fair.
I got it.
Yes.
Do you agree that if such an express reference weren't to be required, that all of the documents you seek in this case would fall under the CIA Act?
Would all the documents that I seek in this case fall under the CIA?
Disclosure of the organization, functions, names, officials, titles, salaries, or numbers of personnel?
Well, first of all, it's my recollection that there has been a recent decision in district court that has limited the scope of that statute, found that statutory provision had been interpreted in an overly broad fashion. So I think that is still an issue as to the scope of that provision. We did not...
It might be in another case, in this case.
In this case, we did not raise it.
You didn't raise it.
Because we were relying on the fact that the DNI had not delegated its power to the CIA to withhold this information.
Can I ask, I'm still confused about how, so I understand how the DNI might do this with respect to an individual FOIA case because there's a number on it, et cetera. But are you saying that without specific delegations, the CIA director can't stop his own employees or set up special programs to protect sources and methods or anything like that every single time has to be a specific delegation?
Well, the Congress was attempting in when it passed the 2004 amendments, was attempting to limit the proliferation of authority to classify information. And it was attempting to facilitate the flow of information to the public. An interpretation that it does that the delegation does not have to extend to the particular documents at issue runs afoul of both of those provisions.
Well, what about, I mean, there's another provision in the NSA Act, which is 3036, which says that the Director of Central Intelligence shall perform such other functions and duties related to intelligence affecting the national security as the President or the Director of National Intelligence may direct.
Yes.
So is...
As why, either one of...
May direct. So why isn't that Intelligence Committee Directive 700 or the President's executive order sufficient? Why isn't... I mean, maybe there's two slightly inconsistent provisions of the NSA Act.
I think it's... inconsistent, and it runs afoul of the purpose of the act.
Okay. Can I ask you about the the question of which executive order governs?
Yes, certainly.
That's the other question that I'm struggling with a little bit. So your position, I understand it, is that the Obama order, which is 13526 is the one that applies rather than the Clinton order or the Bush order, right?
Yes.
Okay. And your reason for that is the Campbell case's discussion of when a new order supersedes.
Right.
Right. All right. So I want to focus with you on a paragraph of Campbell. Campbell says... we conclude that the Clinton order does not permit FOIA litigants to reopen classification decisions finalized before the order's effective date. As with the order reviewed in your namesake, Lazar, the Clinton order defines classified information to include information classified under prior orders and cites see Executive Order 12958.1.1c. Okay, I'm just reading for you.
Yeah.
So... I'm right then that, am I not, that to the extent you're relying on Campbell, you're relying on Campbell's conclusion that the Clinton order permitted previous orders to continue and that provision of the Clinton order that we're talking about was 1.1c. Is that right?
Yes.
All right. So 1.1c of the Clinton order at the time said the following. Classified national security information means information that has been determined pursuant to this order or any predecessor order to require protection under unauthorized disclosure and is marked to indicate its classified status when in documentary form. But that same provision is included in the Obama order. Obama order at 6.1i is verbatim.
Yes, but there is a further provision in the Obama order that sets forth a period of time by which the government agencies must make a determination, and it sets forth a much more daunting standard for allowing the perpetuation of the prior order business. And I don't think they meet that standard in this case.
But that's not what we relied on in Campbell. In Campbell, we relied only on this provision, which is the same.
This order is extraordinarily different than the 12958 order that was at issue in Campbell. It puts limits on passage of time, severe limits. It eliminates after 50 years. There are only two categories of information that can be classified substantively.
One of them is for nuclear weapons. Pardon?
I understand that there's only two.
So there are only two. These records are virtually all over 50 years old. And the continuation of the so-called class. First of all, let me just backtrack. I was going to direct your attention to some documents, and if you turn to page 11.
Are you in a joint appendix, or?
It's in the second appendix, and it's it starts with.
You're referring to joint appendix volume 2, is that?
Yes.
Volume 2, uh-huh. And we start with page 11. 1123. I'm sorry. I wanted to start with eleven twenty-eight. Well, this group of documents that follow 1124 is a group of records that were not made available as a result of the processing under the National War Crimes Disclosure Act. This is admitted to in a footnote to the May 2013 declaration of Michelle Meeks. And they were the result of, I made a motion for a disclosure of some ex parte affidavits that had been filed in the case. And while the government rejected the basis for that motion and said it should not have been made, they produced several documents out of 66 that in 1997, when they moved for summary judgment, had been withheld in their entirety. Some 66 documents had been withheld in their documents. Those documents were not responsive to or not processed under the CIA and the National War Crimes Disclosure Act provisions. They were processed in response to my motion, and while most of them were still withheld, a few were released, and they date back to 1946. They involve a series of meetings held by Alan Dulles at his home on 61st Street in New York City, and other top CIA officials, including not only Dulles, but Richard Helms and James Jesus Angleton, the sort of officials, and these documents relate to Operation Rusty, which was a Galen organization operation. Nothing on them was provided, despite the improved search that was allegedly made in 1985, because these names apparently were not indexed, and apparently Army counterintelligence didn't realize that these were precisely the type of people that were the subject of Oglesby's requests. If you go on a few pages further, to 1145 of the appendix. The CIA has, as the government has represented in this case, that it processed virtually everything imaginable. It greatly broadened the definition of records responsive to Oglesby's request, and it withheld minimal amounts of information. Here you have a document which dates to 1949, 65 years ago. It is almost entirely withheld under two broad claims, B1 and B3. You can't tell where one begins and the other end or whether they're entirely coterminous. The addressee on the document is John J. McCloy, the High Commissioner of Germany. John J. McCloy is notorious for having been the person who freed top convicted Nazis, let them off the hook, even when they'd been convicted at Nuremberg. And he arranged for the Krupp and Thiessen to get favorable treatment. And so, obviously, the question is why, 65 years after the fact, we can't get at information relating to what John McCloy was being told. The obvious implication is that the CIA's declarations notwithstanding, it's very likely that this involves highly embarrassing information that the CIA, despite two congressional laws that overturned the CIA's resistance to releasing acts related to this topic, is still withholding vast material to this day without any proper showing of segregability as to the information being withheld.
All right, let me just ask if there's any questions from the bench. All right, we'll give you some time at the end, Mr. Lasalle.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Haynes, I think we should start with how the case has changed.
Your Honor, the case has a long history.
I really want to know the what happened in the last week.
Okay. And I probably have created a tempest in a teapot. I was talking to the people to prepare for this argument, and I think I misunderstood what their FOIA office told me, which was they had the originals, which if they had the original archival files, then that would have meant that they didn't go to the National Archives. They accessed this material yesterday, and I would like to go look at it before.
So they do have some material, either original or copies. Is that right?
Yeah. Apparently what they did, and I didn't get, I mean, I...
Is the Army?
Yes, the Army, Your Honor. And I want to verify this, but based on what they recently told me, they took the archival material, they made a clean copy, then they made a copy of that, you know, to redact it. So they have the document before they redacted it, but not the archival document. They have that. They have the redactions. They gave it to Mr. Liz. They gave him the 9,000 documents in 1997. And, in fact, they had a tremendous Vaughan index.
I need to cut to the chase here.
Yeah.
Okay. Are there documents that we are still litigating about that it turns out that this Army actually has some version of, copies or originals, and are in fact not totally out of the Army's files and only at NARA?
Okay. They have a clean copy of the material they deemed responsive. It's typical FOIA, then they used that to create the copy that they redacted.
Deemed responsive recently or back when they made the release?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't hear.
Copy the stuff they already released to him?
No. When they responded to Mr. Oglesby FOIA request, they looked through their files, they located what they thought were the responsive materials, and they then made a copy of it, which is their claim.
What year are you talking about that they made this?
1997, Your Honor. And they turned over to Mr. Lazar, or to the appellants, they turned over the redacted and copies. Now, there is a Vaughan Index, and I think the thing that I may have overlooked...
Can we just pause over this? Is what you are saying that of the documents that Mr. Lazar now has, the original unredacted versions, copies or not, are in the possession of the Army? Is that right?
They have an unredacted copy of what they gave him.
Okay,
the
now
archival,
do they have unredacted copies of the documents he is seeking that have not yet been given?
No, because he hasn't challenged, and this is where you get back to the 1997 summary judgment. They gave him a Vaughan Index. They produced 9,000 documents. This is what we're talking about, the 9,000 documents, many of which had very minor redactions, such as the name of a sensitive human intelligence source.
Well, the ones at 1145 and 1146, no one could describe as minor.
Which one? You returned 1145?
The two blank pages we're talking about that Mr. Lazar just pointed out to us.
Which one was that, Your Honor?
JA 1145 and 46? 1145 and 46?
Your Honor, these are not the Army's documents.
Oh, these are the CIA's documents.
These are CIA documents.
All right. We'll get back to that in a minute.
They are the 66 documents, which I think counsel for appellants misstated. They're not the Army's. They're the CIA.
I don't think he misstated. I think I misunderstood. It's not his fault.
Okay, very well.
All right. But what you're saying is that the 9,000 redacted documents that were provided to Mr. Lazar, unredacted versions are available in the Army's files, right?
In the Freedom of Information case file.
Yes, okay. But no others? All other documents relating to the war criminals were both originals, copies, archivals, etc., have been transferred to NARA?
All of their archival materials have been transferred to NARA.
But the question is, did they retain a copy?
They retained a copy of what they gave to appellants.
And nothing else, is that what you're saying?
No, but I'm trying to be clear about this. I understand your answer to the Chief Judge, but they have, after all these years, discovered that they have the copies of what they gave in redacted form to the plaintiff. The question I have is, a week from now, are we going to learn that they also kept copies of everything they transferred to the archives? Do we not know?
Your Honor, they did not keep copies. That we can safely say.
That's the latest information that you have from the Freedom of Information officer?
Yeah. But
do you see what I'm getting at? Is that the Freedom of Information officer has a limited field of knowledge, and now the Freedom of Information officer knows what he or she has, but has any, as it were, search been done beyond that to determine what the Army may have as, you know, a bureaucracy that normally keeps copies of everything that's surrendered?
We do have Mr. Doris's declaration. He's actually...
I know, but we have a problem on the face of Mr. Doris's declaration right now, Mr. Lazar pointed out.
Well, if you think about what a FOIA response is, how it's done, it's not really contrary to Mr. Doris's declaration. He says all of their materials that fall under Nazi War Crimes Disclosure Act, all of that has gone to the National Archives. But if you do a FOIA response, the FOIA people say, here's a responsive document. I make a copy, clean copy. I then make a copy and do the redactions. Now, appellants have not challenged any of the redactions to these 9,000 pages. And they received in 1997 a massive bond index that starts at...
Can I just clarify one thing before you go on? When you said that these copies of what they were turned over, the 9,000 documents you kept, I think you said that they were kept in, they were found in the litigation case file.
Well, it's not, I don't think, it is the FOIA response file.
Okay.
The FOIA response file has each page they think is responsive in a clean copy, and then they make a copy that they redact. So if the...
It's not as though you found documents somewhere else where the agency keeps its normal records. This was, for obvious reason, ongoing litigation. It was simply the litigation file.
It was the FOIA claim file. It was the file of the FOIA office. And if you think about it, that's obviously what you would do. You'd have, but the archival copies have gone to National Archives. Now, this would be a problem if Mr. Lazar challenged that any of the 9,000 pages that were redacted, if the appellants challenged that. They simply haven't. In fact, they admit, I mean, this is not really a disclosure issue. It's kind of a fee issue because National Archives, there's no fee waiver, as this court held in 19...
Yeah, so how does this impact the fee issue?
Well, it impacts it slightly, and this is actually a very complicated point. He says that Ms. Murphy's declaration identified 2,863 pages that were fully released except for 11 pages that were partially declassified that he thinks he doesn't have. And this goes back to the issue of the so-called silver platters. The Counterintelligence Corps of the Army in Europe put on microfilm 13,000, well, they have 13,000 reels. I'm not sure all of it is Counterintelligence Corps, but most of it, that they copied from the paper files, which they destroyed back in, certainly before 1968. Those reels, which were actually not permanent files, were indexed. They were indexed by the Army. However, when they were transferred to the National Archives, they produced a bigger and better index. Additionally, the reels were put on the so-called, it's an optical character recognition system of the 1990s, the silver platters, the jukebox, so that you would pull out a platter and you could do an optical recognition search. Did he receive these? The problem is that when the Army had put all of the microfilm onto the silver platters, which they gave to archives in 2005, when they did that, it was hard to use due to technical issues. So the archives used money that Congress had appropriated, and they transferred all of this to a computer program that could be used. Now, they now have a much better index. They have much better optical recognition capability. Ms. Murphy went through all of the stuff that might be responsive, and they located the 2,863 pages, 11 which were only partially declassified. Now, I cannot say that he got these in 1997. They are fairly easy to reproduce because it's a computer program. You can print them out.
They're available in electronic format now.
They are, Your Honor. And I mean, we could get into more issues with the with this, but we can provide him these 2,863 pages.
So you said you can or cannot?
We can.
But you haven't yet.
We haven't, because the National Archives doesn't do fee waivers, but I think we ought to be able to work this out.
Well, if it's an electronic,
it's very,
fee is for the copy, and if you do it electronically, is there really, do you charge fees for electronic copies?
I don't know that. I do know that they were, that they almost had a stroke at the idea of copying the hard copies of all the stuff in their files because of the tremendous effort.
Can I just, I'm sorry to interject. So you don't have an electronic copy at the Army of these?
No.
Only
because the only thing that they were put onto the silver platters, and that is where they were. They couldn't keep a copy of that. They sent that over to National Archives, which improved the system, improved the index, and...
Well, hang on. What was put onto the silver platter were paper documents.
No, Your Honor. They were the
microfilm.
They were the degraded microfilm. The microfilm was in terrible condition.
Where is that microfilm now?
It has been destroyed, I believe, by the National Archives.
And the computer program that has the digital version of them is at the archives, not at the Army? Is that what you're saying?
That's correct, Your Honor. They started transferring the digital material, I think, in 2000. They finally finished the silver platters to the National Archives in 2005.
When you say they, who is the they here?
It would be the Intelligence and Security Command, INSCOM. It would be the Investigative Records Repository.
They finished providing them in 2005? So all the way until 2005, the Army had custody?
Of some of it. They started in 2000 turning it over.
So this gets back to the question I started to ask Mr. Lazar. Were there documents that you were either under direction from the court or that you had agreed, you meaning the Army or the CIA, had agreed to provide for free because of the fee waiver, a decision by the court, that you then transferred to the archives and no longer have available? Are there any documents in that category?
Based on the 1977 Vaughan Index, I would say as to the hard copies, no.
And as to the microfilm?
Well, the problem there is they have a much better, they've improved the indexing, they've improved the optical character recognition.
So as to those 2,000, would you agree that the Army actually does have an obligation to get back, since there was an agreement to provide these responsive records and an order from the court to provide them for free? Would you agree that the Army has an obligation to get those back and then to provide them to Mr. Lazar?
Well, first of all, there was no order of the court giving the fee waiver.
Oh, there
was the fee waiver was by the Army.
Okay, fine. There was a fee waiver. But there was a fee waiver.
Yes.
All right. And there was an agreement to provide documents that fall into this category, the 2,000.
I'm not sure if there was an agreement to do that. And I'm going out to look at the documents that the FOIA office has. I doubt very much that all of these, I doubt that all of these 2863 were turned over in that, because, simply because of the tremendous improvement in the...
Well, now I'm confused. Are they in the FOIA office or are they at NARA?
The FOIA office may have snippets of the microfilm reels, because these were, and this is one of the problems that, given the 40 or 50 years, these were not permanent files. So sometimes people would take the file and snip something out that they needed for some other reason. To the extent that Mr. Lazar got in 1997, or the appellants got in 1997, to the extent that they got material that was in the microfilm, it's probably reflected in those snippets.
Do you concede the fee waiver survives the substitution and all the passage of time?
Your Honor, we have decided not to argue about that. I mean, the fee waiver was given because of Mr. Oglesby. He's dead. As I understand the plaintiff's position, the reason they're still pursuing this is that the daughter, Erin DeBacco, would like to give all of her father's, or has given all of her father's papers to the University of Massachusetts, so they would like to put these with those papers in the University of Massachusetts. Whether that's a basis for a fee waiver is another question, but we have not raised that in this appeal.
So the answer to Judge Millett's question is yes?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The answer to Judge Millett's question is yes?
You concede that the fee waiver, at least in this case, survives the substitution?
Yes, we concede that because we did not challenge it. Had we challenged it, it would be a different issue. But the fee waiver was not ordered by anybody.
When you say we don't challenge it, you're speaking on behalf of just the Army or the Archives?
Well, the Archives does not give fee waivers.
I know, but aren't you representing them both right now?
There were six of the defendants. The National Archives, State Department, and FBI.
They were all dismissed a while ago.
They were dismissed in 1996. So on appeal, we're representing the CIA, the Army, and NSA. But NSA, they didn't appeal.
The documents you're talking about aren't held by the Army, so I'm trying to figure out how this concession about a fee waiver from the Army is going to apply to our documents that are in the Archives. Or are you saying the only thing the fee waiver would apply to would be if there happened to be microfiche snippets still in the Army FOIA file?
Well, Your Honor, we have, in an effort to resolve this, we're going to arrange for the 2,863 pages to be reproduced. If you reproduce the pages from the computerized database, that is not all that difficult.
All right, so just to be clear, we can wipe this out of the problem in that you will provide those 2,000-some pages for free to the plaintiff,
yes.
Correct?
Okay. Yes.
When?
Mm-hmm. I'll have to ask the agency. And we'll have to talk to Archives. It's simply getting something out of the computer.
Can I switch to Exemption 3 for just a second? There's the argument you know about whether the National Security Act could be invoked by the CIA to protect the documents. Would the CIA Act, which you also invoke, independently protect all the documents? Do we need to decide the National Security Act question that he raises?
I don't actually know the answer to that because our position was a much broader one, and that is that the Director of National Intelligence had delegated properly.
I understand that position. I'm just asking whether we even need to go there if everything, because you invoke two statutes, and if the one independently protects everything, we just don't even need to decide that issue.
I would have to look at what's covered by. I don't know if the CIA Act reaches intelligence sources. It may not. It certainly breaches names of employees, locations of facilities, things of that nature. But I'm not sure that it breaches sources and methods.
Wouldn't that be odd for the CIA Act not to do that? It covers the functions. I think it part of it depends on what functions and names means.
Your Honor, I'm confused, but...
Well, it would be the functions of personnel employed by the agency.
Would be employed by the agency, yeah. But I guess you could argue that's broad enough to cover intelligence.
Well, it depends
sources.
On what your sources and methods are here. We don't know whether they're human or not human. We don't know whether they're employees or non-employees. So I take your position being that since you didn't raise this below, you didn't You're not making this the source. We're not in a position as a fact matter to resolve that question. Is that right?
Well, you raised it. You invoked both statutes.
Yes, we did invoke both statutes because there is overlap. I am just not entirely sure if the CIA Act would cover foreign people that provide information.
Well, look, the Vaughan mark, does the Vaughan Index protect anything other than names of employees?
It protects locations of clandestine facilities. It protects the real names of covert employees. It protects the names of people who are providing information to the CIA. It's actually in the last CIA declaration where they have invoked very, very limited redactions to this material, none of which Mr. Lazar has challenged. I mean, the appellants have not challenged the redactions. They didn't challenge the 1997 redactions. They now argue, they actually concede in their brief that they did receive the Galen Organization records somewhat after they got the 97, or years after they got the 1997 production. And so they only apparently are arguing about the 2,863
pages. Just to further on Judge Millett's point, are you protecting anything other than the names of CIA employees and file markings? Because if that's all you're protecting, then that seems like that would be covered, clearly be covered by the CIA Act also. Or are there non-CIA employees, for example, who are being protected, et cetera?
Your Honor, there is in the record exactly what we're protecting. And it's sources and methods, I think, is the...
Yeah, I know, but that can be very narrow or it can be very broad. Bottom line is you don't know at this point.
I do know what is being protected. Sources and methods, okay. Intelligence methods.
Where are you reading from?
Your Honor, this is in the Vaughan Index provided by Ms. Lutz, December 14, 2012. It starts at 741, and it lists what is being protected.
Right, and I'm sort of looking at that, and almost all of them say name of CIA employee, name of CIA employee. And those,
but if you keep looking, Your Honor, it gets on to CIA intelligence methods,
I see.
Pseudonyms, locations of facilities, intelligence methods.
I see. So some of them would be covered by the other statute.
Yes, I think that's safe to say.
Let me ask you one more question. If they filed today a new FOIA request as to which the 13526 order would apply, and this being 50 years past the time of the classification, would much more be available than is available under the previous executive orders? Because now the limit is confidential human source, your human intelligence source, or design concepts for mass destruction weapons.
The problem, I think, is you've got to recognize that the Exemption 3 statutes still apply. They apply, and they compel them to withhold that sort of material, which is not, you know, the executive order is Exemption B1, but they do have statutory orders in B3 that they're supposed to withhold this material. And I also think they're actually, if it was under the current order, there are some escape hatches. So we have to see what ended up.
Saying that notwithstanding the executive order on classification, the statute requires continued refusal to produce sources and methods? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, but I also think under the new...
Don't the sources and methods have to be classified?
They are classified under B3, Your Honor.
I know, but somebody has to classify them.
Yes.
On some authority.
They classify it under B1, but it still exists as a B3 because they have a statutory obligation to adhere to that statute.
Does it have to be classified to be protected by B3?
If it wasn't classified, it would. If they had failed to classify something, it would still be protected if it fell within B3.
Right, but wouldn't somebody have to decide whether, in fact, it is a intelligence source and method? It says, shall protect intelligence sources and methods from unauthorized disclosure, right? That's what you're talking about is the B3 statute, the NSA statute, right?
Yes.
If the president authorizes disclosure, it's not unauthorized, right?
The president is, by putting out this executive order, the president is not suddenly saying, oh, you don't have to worry about the other statutes which require you to protect intelligence sources.
But it doesn't require you to protect intelligence sources and methods. It just requires you to protect intelligence sources and methods from unauthorized disclosure. Isn't that right? Am I wrong about that?
Yes. Well,
I'm looking at the Exemption 3 statute that we're talking about is Section 3024II, Protection of Intelligence Sources and Methods, right? Is there something else we're talking about? That's the National Security Act.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I'd have to look at this. Here's National Security Act 93A. Well, this you're referring to, this would be 50 U.S.C.
3024.
I.
Right.
Yes.
That is the Exemption 3 statute we're talking about, right?
Yes.
And it doesn't say you can't disclose sources and methods. It says shall protect intelligence sources and methods from unauthorized disclosure, right?
That's correct.
And what could unauthorized mean? Are you saying the president may never authorize the disclosure of sources and methods?
No, it can be actually authorized if a decision is made that the public benefit overrides the damage to national security.
And isn't that what the executive, by the president's order, isn't he making that determination with respect to 50-year-old material with two exceptions?
I would like to read in detail the order because it's very lengthy, and I don't think it gets rid of Exemption 3. I would have to, but the president obviously could order them to turn it over because people have the authority to make a decision that it's in the public interest.
Right. So you are, as I understand, relying on Section 3. On the Obama order. Are you saying, isn't that right?
We're not relying on the President Obama's order, Your Honor. We're relying on the orders that were in effect when the material was classified, which was not President Obama's order.
Right, and your position is that the Obama order can't apply, right?
That's correct.
Right. And so my question is, if they file today, it's not when it's classified, it's when it's filed, when the FOIA request is filed, right?
Yes, that's correct.
So if they filed it today, for 50-year-old material, isn't the purpose of the Obama under Section H, under 3.3H, to automatically declassify 50-year-old material subject to two exceptions?
The question you would have to ask, I think they also have a further escape hatch under President Obama's order.
Yes, in extraordinary cases, agency heads may, within 5 years of the onset of automatic declassification, propose to exempt additional, but we're past that too.
Well, they may have done that, Your Honor. I mean, they have a whole groups of people that do this declassification work under the executive orders. I mean, we don't know what has been done, and they have to report. Apparently, there's an organization that they report to, the name of which escapes me. But we had no idea whether the CIA or the NSA or any of them have used that provision. So it's really not, we don't have to reach that here, and we don't know the facts.
Any further questions?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. I know Ms. Lazar is out of time, but we'll give you two more minutes. Mrs. Lazar, I hate to use up some of your time, but I need to just understand the facts. So were there, in addition to the documents that you received from the Army, the 9,000,
yep,
were there additional ones that the Army, other than maybe these now new 2,000, which they're going to give you, are there additional ones still pending and that were pending at that time, the time after you were given the fee waiver?
I don't know, because the record is totally insufficient and incomplete to answer the question. My guess is that, yes, there must be. Certainly, it's clear that the search was totally inadequate. For example, with respect to Army records, in 1985, when it had its searched for Fort Hunt, and it said it didn't find anything. It did not search for Post Office Box 1142, which was the code name for Fort Hunt.
No, I understand that. Assume that just for the purpose of this, so I can separate the issues out, assume that we were to say that the search was sufficient. Then were there anything further pending? I'm interested in this question of whether you were entitled to some documents for free, which were then transferred to the archives, and so you can't get them for free.
And the answer is, I think that we don't have a sufficient record. The record is totally confused. It doesn't even agree as to when records were transferred to the National Archives. The Murphy Declaration is inconsistent with the Doris Declaration. At least on its face, it seems to be inconsistent as to when the records were transferred to the National Archives. So we don't know. We've got no paper trail to show, because no report was ever made to the district court as to what was happening and what was going on. The case just disappeared. Now, what I want to call your attention to is on this issue of when things were classified. If you go back and take a look at, starting with page 1125 and to the pages all the way up to the two pages entirely withheld, there are no classification markings on those pages except top secret. We don't know when it was placed, who it was placed by. There are no declassification markings at all. This is true not only of this group of records, which was
but we've discussed this before. The executive order permits non-marked documents to continue with the general classification stamp.
At one time, back in the 1940s, this was probably sufficient, but subsequent orders specified that there be markings placed on documents.
No, but I thought, but it also says information classified, I'm just reading from the order, information classified under predecessor orders that contain no declassification instructions. I'm sorry, information marked for an indefinite duration of classification under predecessor orders Shall, no, wait a minute. I'm on the wrong page. Hold on a second. I'm sorry, it's
F. Is this Obama?
I'm on the Clinton one.
Clinton.
It's F, 1.3F. Information assigned a level of classification under this or predecessor order shall be considered as classified at that level of classification despite the omission of other required markings.
Well, but there is, under the current executive order, there is an exception to that, a provision that provides that within 5 years they must make a determination, and it requires extraordinary circumstances to continue that grandfather provision.
All right, so that would depend on a decision that this case is unlike Campbell and that the new order would have to apply. Is that
right?
Right.
Okay, yes.
Fair enough.
Right. I would say that I would call attention to the fact that the Army, in conducting its search previously, their current claim is that they didn't search for Fort Hunt because it's a geographical location. The problem with that is that previously, back in 1985, they did search for it. So they're inconsistent as to that. And again, they did not search for P.O. Box 1142. There has been abundant new information that has come to light since this court's prior decisions, which indicates that Fort Hunt was a massive facility with 100 billion, with 100 buildings, with over 100 translators interrogating people, and 3,000 prisoners being interrogated. All of this has disappeared in the records of the all of these agencies. None of them has been able to find it. They've not conducted an adequate search. They've been relying on inadequate index searches, but searches cannot be confined to indices. The law of this circuit is quite plain that an index search alone is not sufficient. I refer you in that regard to the Nation magazine case.
Okay. Are there further questions from the bench? At least for my own purposes, I would appreciate it if the Army would provide us, I don't know, by the middle of next week or the end of next week.
No, it's a holiday.
I'm sorry?
It's a holiday.
Not next week isn't a holiday yet, is it?
Well, it's
Before the holiday. Before the holiday. Before the holiday.
Are we going to define the holidays?
By the 19th. By the 19th. Just way before the holiday, right? A confirmation of its representation that the 2,000-plus documents that you were talking about will be reproduced and provided to the plaintiff for free. Is that okay? Thank you. Okay.
I'm sorry,
Please, go ahead.
You said you were going to go back and examine their records? Sorry, you're going to examine the records at the Army as well to see if there were other things that might be in there? Do you know if that will happen by then, that you could report on the results of that?
We could do both. What I was going to do, I think, confused. I was thinking they had the archival original, but we will verify that actually what they had was the copy, which was their copy that they then redacted. They kept the original, redacted it, and gave it to a company.
Well, and also you referenced microfiche snippets as well.
We can address the microfiche snippets because if they used them, they should be in their FOIA file.
If so, we can get all that in a letter from you by the 19th, that would be excellent.
Could it be a letter, Your Honor, or a filing?
I think a letter is fine with us.
But filed on the record.
Yes. I don't want any secret filings from you. Just a joke. Okay, thank you, Ms. LaSalle.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the matter under submission.